Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jake.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
Is it true?
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they are sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road, and, you know, anyway. Okay, well, welcome. This is Eric.
This is Grinchy Brother Jay.
And tonight, we're going to talk about the 1988 movie Scrooged, directed by Richard Donner. Now, Richard Donner directed things such as Superman, The Omen, Lethal Weapons 1, 2, 3, and 4, Maverick, Conspiracy Theory, The Goonies, and Lady Hawk. So it's fair to say Richard Donner is the director of our childhood.
That's quite the assortment of movies.
Yeah, he's a good director. Although there's a piece of direction I wish he gave more often in this movie, but we'll talk about that. So tell me, is this on your list of judgment?
No.
Okay. How did this movie find you?
I'm positive that we saw this in the movie theater. I want to say as a family, but I can't swear to that.
I was not in the movie theater. I did not. I have never seen this movie until this week.
Seriously.
Maybe
I saw it with friends. I saw it in the movie theaters, 1988. This would have been right before I got hired at the, so I wouldn't have been working yet at the theater. You know, maybe I saw it with like Brady and his family. It may have been. Kind of thinking, I'm probably thinking this was junior high or high school. This was high school at that point. So I would have gone with my high school buddies on the weekend to see this, probably. In fact, I'm almost certain of that.
And do you have fond memories of this movie?
I did like this. I thought it was a great movie when I saw it.
And upon further review?
I got a lot more of the jokes.
Oh, well, that's cool.
I understood it a lot more. So from the perspective of being, you know, I would have been 15, 16 when I saw this. And I got some of the jokes. Also, this was a mean-spirited movie.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it was.
I say that because there are several points where it is openly, I'm not sure what the term is. I don't know if you want me to get right into this.
Oh, yeah. No.
There was a line in the movie, and I would not have got it at the time, but I got it last night and made me laugh out loud. It was totally mean-spirited. It was a very mean-spirited kind of, and it was meant to be funny, and it was funny. It made me laugh, but it was also really mean. So there's a point in the movie where Bill Murray, he's in the restaurant with the executive and the other guy.
Yes.
And so the Frank character sees the waiter on fire, and he throws the bucket of water over the waiter.
Yes.
And he says,
"I'm sorry. I thought you were Richard Pryor."
And I would not have got that in 1988. I absolutely got it last night. Having not seen this, I haven't seen this movie in probably a decade, but it made me laugh out loud. But then I'm like, wow, that was harsh. That was mean and dark.
Yeah, that was, there's a lot of darkness in this movie that I don't see gets alleviated even at the end, but
this is a very dark movie, but it is a funny Christmas movie, and it is kind of a twist on, you know, on the Dickens, the, you know, Christmas Carol. So I get that it's kind of an homage and kind of very meta, kind of retelling of the story. I got a lot, like I said, I got a lot more of it last night. I watched it last night.
Well, I've got some problems with this movie, but it's not the telling of the story that I think is a problem. I mean, we'll get into some specific things, but yeah, I mean, it's got all the right elements to it. There's just a couple things that really rub me the wrong way. Plus, did you know how this movie was marketed?
No.
Well, this was right off of Ghostbusters, and it's maybe it was off of right after Ghostbusters 2, one of the two, and it says it's Bill Murray fighting ghosts again, except this time it's 3-1. So if you were expecting to go into it seeing Bill Murray, the Ghostbusters character, I think you would have been shocked. Because had you expected this to be like Groundhog Day? Like if you had seen Groundhog Day and then seen Scrooged, I think you would have been less surprised. I don't know. It just seems like he is not a very nice guy. And that doesn't change a whole lot. Anyway.
No, not really.
Yeah. So, okay. Shall we get into the plot?
Yeah.
Okay. So, again, this has all the right elements to it. It opens up with this long, I guess, crane shot of with bombastic holiday music. And the camera goes along to Santa's workshop. And I believe every member of the Roloff family is working at the workshop.
So, I'm going to interrupt just a moment. So Ghostbusters was 84. Ghostbusters 2 wasn't until 89.
Okay, so it was
after Ghostbusters, but right before Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah. So anyway, so we have Santa and the Roloff family, and we end up, we realize that this is actually a trailer for the Christmas feature, The Night the Reindeer Died, starring Lee Majors.
Which is awesome.
Oh yeah, it's totally awesome. Totally fun, over the top. And then we cut to a trailer for Robert Goulet's Cajun Christmas, which is
awesome.
Also very, very funny. And then we have a trailer for the holiday episode of Father Loves Beaver.
Which is also awesome.
Yes. And then we see the trailer. Then we realize, of course, that this is all being shown to the president of IBC Television Network, Bill Murray, as Frank Cross. And then they show the trailer or the promo for the live production on Christmas Eve of Scrooge, starring Buddy Hackett, Jamie Farr, the Solid Gold Dancers, and Mary Lou Retton as Tiny Tim, hosted by Sir John Houseman. It will touch your every heartstring. You'll love it, Y-U-L-E.
Yeah. I wrote at this point, I'm like, wow, this movie is a tad dated because of the people. And then I wrote, instead of Bob Goulet, it would be Michael Bublé nowadays. And instead of Lee Majors, they would have Chuck Norris.
Maybe. Or maybe Dwayne Johnson.
Maybe. He would be a good choice.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking, how about Dwayne Johnson and would it be a Katy Perry joint?
No, I said Michael Bublé.
Yeah. Would it be Bublé on nationwide TV? Oh, maybe. Maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
Why not? He's a crooner.
Yeah, that's true.
Or maybe it could be Josh Groban, but I can't stand his guts, so.
Yeah, see, I don't know his guts, so I assume anybody from one of those talent shows on TV, I'm sure, could do a fine, fine job.
Oh, yeah, that I'm out of my depth at that point. So.
But no one will compare it to Robert Goulet and his Cajun Christmas.
And the big, giant, crazy crocodile alligator thing.
Oh, yeah, he's in a little skiff with the pole going through the bayou. So we see Bill Murray as Frank Cross, the president of IBC Television Network, and he's the youngest president of any television network, and he hates the Scrooge promo. One of his ad execs, Elliot Loudermilk, played by Bobcat Goldthwait, suggests that the promo has been doing fine. You know, it's been airing and it's doing fine. And Bill Murray has the quote,
"We have spent $40 million on a live TV show. You guys have got an ad with America's favorite old fart reading a book in front of a fireplace. Now, I have to kill all of you."
Which I think is kind of a funny line.
It was a good line.
But then he shows the promo that he cut for it, and it's all very dark and urgent and full of, like, if it bleeds, it leads kind of hyperbole.
It's a very Mad Max Christmas.
Exactly. Yeah, which has nothing to do with the actual program, but he doesn't care. He just wants to get eyeballs viewing the screen. So because Elliot Loudermilk questioned him, Bill Murray decides to code 9 him.
Yeah, and I wrote down, Bobcat? ? And then I put, oh, yes, a very young Bobcat. I think maybe a semi-silver Bob. Oh, no, not silver. And then I wrote down, code 9, he fires people so often that they already have a code in place.
Oh, yeah, it's great. Now, in this part where Bill Murray plays the Scrooge character, it's actually pretty good, except that I've got a problem with Bill Murray's performance. You want to guess what it is?
He's too smiley?
No, he's yelling. Everybody is talking in a normal tone of voice during the whole movie, except Bill Murray, who is yelling every single thing. It totally, like, bothered me.
Oh. But yeah, I didn't really notice that.
Anyway, just get back to Bobcat for a second. This was just after the Police Academy movies for him, but before he started directing. Like, he directed Shakes the Clown in the 93, I think. And then he's been doing TV directing ever since. Like, he directed Jimmy Kimmel Live, and he's directing a lot of the episodes of The Marin Show, and he directed The Man Show and some of The Chappelle Show.
I have always had a fondness for Bobcat Goldthwait, so.
Yeah, have you seen God Bless America?
Uh-uh.
It is really worth seeing. It's a super dark comedy. Maybe we should do it as a episode of the podcast, because it's really worth seeing.
You're a fan?
Oh, I am a very big fan. Have you seen the movie Sleeping Dogs Lie?
No.
Okay, I have not seen that one, but I love the premise. The premise is a girlfriend, I think maybe to her fiance, confesses to a drunken romantic encounter with her pet dog, and it changes their whole relationship.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So isn't that a great premise for a comedy?
Change the premise of your relationship. I think you just took a back seat to Fido.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like, hey, Sleeping Dog, can't we just let Sleeping Dogs Lie?
No.
It was one time, man. Anyway.
No.
Well, that's the premise. Again, I haven't seen the movie. I assume it's handled with delicacy. But,
by the way, I was going to say not to go down this rabbit hole, but, but appropriate as it be, you know, there was a fair bit of bestiality talk in this movie.
A little bit. Yeah.
Uncomfortably. So I thought, oh, it made me uncomfortable. Like, I don't know.
We'll have to get there when we get there. But,
yeah,
cause I don't remember a specific incident of like full on bestiality talk. I know there was a lot of animal abuse talk, but
okay. Well, when we get there.
Okay. All right. So we learn a couple things about, Frank Cross. He's an asshole. We know that. His, drink of choice is vodka and tab
and Stoli.
Yes. And, he's got, of course, an overworked, overwrought secretary, Grace, played by the lovely Alfre Woodard.
Who does a good job in this role.
Yeah, she does fine. And she's got several children. One, whose name is Calvin, he doesn't speak. And there's a little bit of cruelty that happens to him in the beginning of the movie that I thought was pretty dark, but we'll get there in just a second. So, next we meet Frank is... met by the whole, I guess, I don't know what his title is, but like the entire, like president of the entire thing or whoever owns the network or whatever.
And yeah, that's, like the chairman or something.
Yeah. He calls him Mr. President, but he also mentions being a president himself, Frank is. So I have no idea. Anyway, that's Preston Rhinelander, played by Robert Mitchum. And Robert Mitchum, he's always been underrated, but I think he's pretty funny. And, you know, he's a movie star. He can, you know, he's playing this pretty well. Anyway, he wants Frank to start programming the network based on his information that dogs and cats are watching TV and they're going to be a big part of the viewership in the next 20 years. So yeah,
this is also the point at which you're introduced to his brother, who, by the way, is actually his brother in real life.
Oh, yeah. I think all of his brothers.
Yeah. Well, later on, his other brother plays his father.
Yes. Yes.
Brian Doyle Murray plays
yes,
his father.
Exactly.
Later on.
But, yeah, and his brother James was fine. Although, you know who brother James' wife is?
Yeah.
His wife, Wendy?
Yeah, yeah. No, I know. I have to turn the channel.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll get there in a second. Sorry. Frank has a small encounter with the needle-nosed Ned of Scrooged, and that's Bryce Cummings, played by John Glover from Smallville. And this is where my first note says that Bill Murray is overacting like crazy. I mean, he's totally shouting where everybody's speaking at a normal volume. But not to drive the point too far home that he's a bad guy, he wins a humanitarian award, which he leaves in a cab. A cab, by the way, that the fare was $4.85, and he gives the cabbie a $5.
Yeah, he's all heart.
Yeah, he's going back to work. And this is where we see how Grace's son, Calvin, doesn't speak. He's the Tiny Tim character in this little story. He doesn't speak. And so, for some reason, because he doesn't speak, they dress him up like a Christmas tree.
Yeah, it was kind of terrible.
Yeah. Well, then the ghost of Lou Hayward, John Forsythe, shows up. And
it's awesome, by the way.
Oh, yeah, he was awesome. And the makeup effects in this movie were pretty good.
I know. I was shocked. Not only that, the special effects. So, you know, when the character holds him and pushes him through the glass window.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah.
And yet they did a lot of really cool practical stuff that was fun, too. Lou Hayward was the former president of the network. In fact, he's the man who invented the miniseries. But he wishes he had been kinder. So then, of course, he tells Frank that Frank will be visited by 3 ghosts, starting the first one appearing at noon the next day. Now, this is where we meet the network censor. I believe it's the next morning, or maybe it's later that night. It must be the next morning. The network censor, and they have a little conversation about nipples.
I'm sorry, Mr. Cross. I am the censor, and I will not allow this costume on the air.
Why not?
Well, specifically, you can see her nipples.
I want to see her nipples.
But this is a Christmas show.
Well, Charles Dickens would have wanted to see her nipples then.
You can hardly see them nipples.
See, and these guys are really looking. You can go shake a tail feather. Thanks. And thank you. You can just go. Oh, watch out. Ah! Thanks, boys. Get the nurse.
But then there's a running gag where the network censor keeps getting injured on the set. But then, during his encounter with Lou Hayward, the phone mysteriously dials his old girlfriend, Claire Phillips, played by Karen Allen, of Raiders of the Lost Ark fame. And the next day on set, because he left a voicemail message, she shows up and calls him by his nickname, Lumpy. And we learn that she's a granola-eating, like, hippie freak trying to save the world. And, of course, Frank is the button-up businessman trying to run it. Frank also then accosts Grace's son on the set in a pretty brutal fashion. And he's still shouting. This is when Grace comes up to him and, you know, tells him, hey, it's my son. I thought he might enjoy watching a live production. But she's carrying, did you see her cell phone?
No, I didn't see it.
It's one of those gigantic, like, purse-sized cell phone bags with the phone that comes out with a cord on it.
Oh, jeez.
It was awesome. It was really a sign of the times there. So he breaks for lunch. And so, of course, they go to lunch at noon. And he's eating lunch with Rhinelander. And Frank talks about how the show is going and how it's going to be a worldwide affair where they're going to cut to Berlin, where Leroy Neiman is going to paint the wall, and then to South Africa, where the Pope is going to baptize the entire Zulu nation.
Which is hilarious.
Oh, yeah. You'll notice that there's a couple of Free South Africa. There's a Free South Africa bumper sticker, I think, and also the Free South Africa or End Apartheid poster that show up in this movie.
Oh, there's also Free South Africa image that they have in the control room towards the end. So it pops up all over the place.
Yeah. So it's good stuff. But then Bryce Cummings shows up, and Rhinelander has had him come aboard to help Frank since he's been spreading himself a little thin. Okay. So Frank thinks that Bryce is actually the ghost promised by Hayward because it's right at noon that Bryce shows up. And he does this uncomfortable, aha! But not to be outdone by that, then the worst waiter in the entire world shows up and serves him a glass of water that has an eyeball in it. And there's more, ah! That's more of that kind of thing going on.
And the waiter reminded me of Jeff Von Vonderen from Intervention fame.
Who? I don't know. I don't know the reference.
Yeah. So if you go look up, I'll send you a link to Jeff Von Vonderen.
Okay.
Travis knows who he is. Anyway, the waiter and him, they have an uncanny resemblance.
Oh, well, that's funny. Yeah. The reason I said he was the worst waiter in the world is because then Frank looks across and sees at another table, another waiter is lighting the flame on a baked Alaska. And Frank thinks that he has lit himself on fire, the waiter has lit himself on fire. And so he starts screaming and pointing, and it's his turn to order. So the waiter keeps saying, no, that's a dessert, sir. You don't want that. And then, no, that man is eating meatloaf. You wouldn't like that. It's not very good. Like, what waiter is going to tell you that the meatloaf is not very good?
And what waiter is going to tell you if you don't want a baked Alaska, which probably, by the way, costs $25 for you to purchase, but costs the restaurant like 15 cents to make?
Oh, yeah.
Like, they're not going to trot that thing out for your fat ass to eat.
Oh, yeah. They would absolutely trot that out for you to eat.
Yeah. And by the way, in the homage of our grandmother, you know, what's the catchphrase?
I'm sorry. You know, I thought you were Richard Pryor.
No. It's about eating dessert first.
Jeez. Oh yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, yes, eat dessert first. I'm like, I don't know where you're going with it. It's the only quote I have written down there. But yeah, no, our grandmother always said eat dessert first.
Yeah, no, I was just saying, in the spirit of the waiter not telling him, but yes, then that comes to the inevitable point of like, you know, I thought you were Richard Pryor, which I laughed out loud. It made me laugh because I got the joke. And then I was like, that's really mean.
Oh yeah. And for the younger,
really mean spirited.
Yeah.
And for something that isn't even involving Richard Pryor. I mean, why would you bring that kind of topical humor into a movie that seemingly unrelated, unless it was, you know, was it prescient at the time? Was it an event that had just occurred? I mean, I wasn't ultimately all that aware in 1988 of my surroundings to the degree that I am now. So, you know, I was a teenager, so, you know, it was all about me. So I don't know. But looking back, I'm just like, wow, what a mean-spirited kind of jibe.
Yeah, I'm actually looking it up.
Are you Googling what year was Richard Pryor on fire?
Yes.
Please tell me that's what you typed.
I put Richard Pryor burned. Actually, you know what? Hang on just a second. I'll be right back in like 2 seconds. Or actually, more like a minute. Not in a Creepy Way, we'll be back after these messages. As always, we'd love feedback. Call us on our feedback hotline at 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. And we're back.
It was 1980.
I know, so it wasn't even topical.
I know, that's why I don't understand why. I don't know if there was some, maybe there was some kind of, was there some animosity between Bill Murray and Richard Pryor that this was his final? I don't know. Anyway, it just was an odd line, you know, or maybe it was a writer who'd been trying to get that line in a movie for years and just finally found a way to work it in somewhere.
That, you know what? I think you may be right on that one. That would make much more sense than anything else. Because, like I said, yeah, it's 1980. This is 1988. It's not topical humor.
Yeah. So that's why it just didn't, it was one of those things where, you know, and like I said, as a kid, I totally didn't get the joke. I mean, I just didn't get it.
Oh, yeah. Well, and yeah, sorry, too, for younger listeners of this, the podcast, in 1980, Richard Pryor was in, I believe, a hotel room, freebasing cocaine and drinking 151 rum and set himself on fire. So it was a pretty bad deal. And then in 1982, he made it that story part of his stand-up routine.
He made lemons out of lemonade.
He did, no. I think he made lemonade out of lemons.
No, I meant it. He made lemons out of lemonade.
Okay, yeah. Anyway, so, anywho. Yeah, but it turns out it wasn't the cocaine that killed him. It was MS, right?
Yeah, I think so.
It's very sad. Anyway, so Frank, after dousing the waiter with the champagne bucket full of ice water and saying he thought he were Richard Pryor, he jumps into a cab driven by the ghost of Christmas Past, David Johansen, who is, of course, Buster Poindexter. And another running gag, Elliot, like, has just bought some alcohol to drown his sorrows. And, of course, the cab drives by and the ghost of Christmas Past grabs the bottle from him and tries to drink it, or does drink it. So poor Elliot can't get a break. And then they go to 1955.
Did you say that was Buster Poindexter?
Yes.
It was not Buster Poindexter.
Yes, it was. David Johansen is Buster Poindexter.
Really?
Yep. Yeah. Hot.
I don't understand. My brain is now broken.
Isn't it, though?
How is that even possible?
He's an actor and performer. Buster Poindexter was an act? Yes, no, Buster Poindexter was a character. Absolutely.
This broke my brain.
I'm sorry. Anyway, yeah. To all the younger listeners, you won't know who Buster Poindexter is either, but still, very funny.
My head hurts.
So they go back to 1955, and at first, Frank is not impressed.
Sorry.
That's okay. I know, it takes a while to recover.
I need a moment. I think I just lost my mind. Sorry, to back up a moment.
Yeah.
We forgot a point that I wrote down.
Okay.
So after he and his brother have his little chat and they go walking to go to the restaurant, and he's yelling at all the people on the street, like they ought to be arrested and all that. The band on the street. Did you notice that was Paul Schaefer?
Yeah, and like David Sanborn and who is it, like Buddy Miles, or who is the guy playing the horn? Like, it was, they were all serious musicians.
It was so strange, just kind of, it was just, like, there's so many odd, like, weird people in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's directed by Richard Donner, and starting Bill Murray. I mean, you should have all of the 80s in there.
Yeah.
So, back to 1955, and we visit Frank at his house when he's just a kid, where he's watching the television, which he did his entire youth. And on Christmas Eve, Brian Doyle Murphy as his dad shows up, and
Murphy.
I think I did that before, actually. In Groundhog Day, I called him Doyle Murphy. Anyway, yeah, I think I spelled it Brain Doyle Murray anyway on my notes, but that's okay. So anyway, Frank's dad is a butcher. And he brings home for Frank's Christmas gift is 5 pounds of veal, which, you know, as the adult Frank points out, was actually worth a considerable amount of money.
Here, Francis, I've got something for you. Merry Christmas.
A choo-choo train?
No, it's 5 pounds of veal.
But Daddy, I asked Santa for a choo-choo.
Well, then go out and get a job and buy a choo-choo.
Ah, Earl, he's only 4 years old.
All day long, I listen to people give excuses why they can't work. My back hurts, my legs ache. I'm only 4. The sooner he learns that life isn't given to you on a silver platter, the better.
So he didn't get his Christmas wish. And he's a little verklempt. I mean, this is where I thought, okay, Frank is going to be a little moved here. Because the essence of A Christmas Carol is that Scrooge, who's just a bad guy, ends up seeing the light and how he's wasted his life being so money grubbing, and he wants to return the favor, and he's a changed man. And the problem I had with this movie is I don't think Bill Murray's character changed all that much.
Well, and also, they really went to great lengths to make him a really sad, kid, even though, like, he didn't seem like a sad kid in that existence. He seemed like a pretty happy kid. But they made it later on in the movie, they went to great pains to say that all of his memories of his childhood were from TV. Like, he didn't have any experiences. All the experiences that he thinks he had, he's incorporated into his life, were just TV.
Well, and this is an anti-TV movie, actually. Because, yeah, he wasted his life watching TV. And what kind of madman would put a live television show on Christmas Eve when families should be together instead of watching TV? So this is a not too subtle jab right at television.
Yeah. No, it's not subtle.
No.
Scissors.
Yes. Yeah, so he's all verklempt. And again, I had hopes. I thought we're going to be able to pull this off. Then they go to 1968, where he's at the company Christmas party. And this is where I loved his hair. Except in 1969, he has roughly the same hair, but a different clothing, and he looks like Joey Buttafuoco. Also a reference younger listeners will not understand, but look it up, Joey Buttafuoco. Spell like it sounds. But so Bill Murray is way too driven at his job, but he ends up meeting Claire, and we learned why she calls him Lumpy. That's because he's walking along the street, she opens a door and smacks him in the head.
And they both try to pick up what he's dropped, they hit their heads, and then she hits him in the front, so he's got bumps all over his head.
Yeah, and he, again, you think he's being charming because he's fallen madly in love with her at first sight, but he's still, and again, I don't know whether it's just Bill Murray, but he's still, like, smarmy.
Yeah, he's still a jerk.
Yeah, he's kind of condescending even in his being lovesick. Then we go to 1969, where he and Claire are living together, and he gets her the gift of 12 sharp knives.
Also, but you notice in the bathtub, she's like toking up a joint.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that cements her as a hippie freak, I think.
Yeah. But yeah, no, he gives her the Ginsu knives.
Yes, although they call him Jinsu, which is really funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they get his head of Ginsu knives, but she gives him a Kama Sutra coffee table book.
Yes, and this is where the dirty bestiality starts.
Oh, okay, I see.
Because they have like a 3-minute conversation about like all the things that he can do to her and that he needs to check her for fleas and that, you know, he bets that she can be just icky and uncomfortable. Oh. And maybe it was because it was him, but I was like, oh, so gross.
Oh, I didn't even catch that because in the next scene, we learned that what does Frank do on his day job? He plays Frisbee the dog.
Which is why it made it even more creepy.
Oh, yeah. So he's in a dog costume for a children's show. And did you notice that Frisbee's tree actually says Dick Loves Lauren on it?
No.
If you look, there's a heart on Frisbee's tree that says Dick Loves Lauren. Dick, by the way, is Richard Donner, and Lauren is his wife. Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, that's cute.
That's very sweet, yeah. So he's invited to go to a Christmas Eve dinner or party or something with the head honcho. Just as Claire shows up and he's like, oh, hey, let's go to this Christmas party. And she goes, no, we have to have a party with our best friends. And he's clearly more into his career than into to being with their best friends. Thought it was a little over the top.
Yeah, I thought this was kind of a galactic overreaction on her part. Kind of a disproportionate rage. Like, you know, like, I have a career. Ostensibly supporting us, and you know, I'm putting myself in a sweaty dog costume, which is, I think, at least from my perspective, a pretty big sacrifice if you ask me. And the you know, the president asks him out. Now, I don't know, but for the career and importance, I would think that takes a little precedence over best friends Christmas Eve. I think my friends would understand, but her reaction is not to be just mad at him, but to be so mad at him, she's like, I think we need to not be a couple.
Yeah, which is a little strange because he's just not going to come home that night or something? How does that work out logistically?
I know. It's like the whole thermonuclear option. I mean, she just went scorched earth, like just you know. Yeah. So, I mean, I know it's dramatic tension and it was to set up, you know, the whole rest of the movie, but like, that kind of really took me out of the movie.
Well, it speaks to a lack of chemistry between them anyway.
Yeah.
So, and because Bill Murray, at least in this character, but I think actually in most characters, has those like cold, dead eyes, it's hard to find him warm anyway. I don't know. It just seems, again, I guess I'm not a big Bill Murray fan. I like Bill Murray,
but in certain roles.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love his brother, Brain Doyle Murphy, but, I don't know. Anyway, so I didn't like him in this role. And I didn't like Karen Allen as Claire either. I didn't think that she was really very well acted either.
No, I think this is one of those, she was kind of in the community. And so she just kind of came up as one of the people like, oh, we could get her.
Oh yeah. Well, and she would have been in Raiders of the Lost Ark already. So,
but at the end of the movie, spoilers, when she and Frank kiss, you notice like it's a lot of her like very obvious closed mouth, not wanting kiss.
Cause,
I mean, it was clear like that was all Bill Murray, like Bill Murray as Bill Murray trying to get a kiss from her, and her like, not if you paid me for this movie.
Yeah, I guess. So anyway, at this point, Frank returns to the present, and because he returns right on the set of Scrooge, he is sure that he has been tricked by all these people. So he starts yelling at people in the cast and the crew members, and he's going to go visit Claire at her work to prove that she's a fraud also. My notes say Frank is still screaming and rambling. Like, all the way, he's doing a monologue all the way down the road to the Operation Outreach. And as he's waiting for Claire, he meets some homeless folks who think that he's Richard Burton, which is just an opportunity for him to do his Richard Burton impression, which I'm sure he must have had locked and loaded for SNL. Like, he must have done a famous Richard Burton impression.
It was terrible.
Yeah, it was. But again, I don't know, maybe it was a good Richard Burton impression, but who the hell knows who Richard Burton is anyway these days?
That's true, too.
Yeah, so anyway, so this is where he comes and he's going to take Claire out to Chinese food. And I'll drop in the big quote here. But he ends up telling her, because he ends up, some volunteers interrupt them.
Claire. Oh,
what Claire. Are you doing here?
Claire. Well, you said if it happened again, then I should come by.
Well, what happened?
Well, I have been thinking a lot about the past. And, you know, when that happens, you start thinking to yourself, well, I've made a lot of decisions, you know.
Yeah.
And what would have happened if I had made different decisions? Do you know what I mean?
Are you talking about regret?
Yeah, I'm talking about regret. Yeah.
Well, you know, the one good thing about regret is that it's never too late. You can always change if you want to. I deal with that every day.
Okay, well, deal with this. I want to take you someplace right now and eat Chinese food.
Claire, we got some huge problems this time. There ain't a fuse in the whole joint.
Oh, no, there are fuses. I'll show you where they are in just a second, Hazel.
The A&P didn't send any turkeys.
No.
Oh, no. They were supposed to be here hours ago.
Now, why?
Okay, well, I'll call them in just a second.
No,
can
no.
you wait? Could you wait for me?
Can handle this. This isn't a big deal. No. I mean, it's just some fuses. You go down to the hardware store and you buy fuses.
Well, what about the turkeys?
And the turkeys are at the A&P? Look it up in the phone book.
No.
It's under A.
If
you can't find it there, it's under P.
I have to call them myself. I'll call them.
You don't have to call them. These are big girls, very big girls, and they can do it. Atta girl.
I'll be right there.
No, okay. Claire, please, fire these people.
Fire them?
Yeah, you fire them.
They're volunteers. They're here out of the kindness of their heart.
They're volunteers because no one will pay them. They are incompetent.
It's Christmas Eve.
They're like this every day of the year. I guarantee it.
If you just wait 1 minute, I just got to make the phone call.
No,
just,
don't bother. Don't bother, okay?
If you just wait 1 minute, let me just finish organizing what I'm doing. I'll come with you, Frank.
Take the rest of your life. I'm going to give you some advice, Claire. Scrape them off.
You want to save somebody? Save yourself.
Oh, well, that's a wonderful attitude to have on Christmas Eve. Merry Christmas.
But we get to see Anne Ramsey.
Who's Anne Ramsey?
Throw Mama from the Train, Anne Ramsey.
Oh,
she's Anne Ramsey.
Ah, okay. So she's one of homeless woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I love that gesture that the black volunteer lady does, where she like hits her chest with both like fingertips and throws her hands out. I've never seen that done, at least maybe ever. But it must have been a thing. I'm going to try to work that into my general mannerisms. If somebody does something exasperating, I'll just put both hands up on my chest and tap myself and put my hands out real fast. Anyway, so then we go back to the set. And this is where we have the only actual fun line from pretty much anybody who's involved in the production of Scrooge. And that's where Buddy Hackett flubs his line.
Ebenezer Scrooge hurried past the ragged boys who stood shivering in the snow, gnawed and mumbled by the hungry cold as bones are gnawed by dogs.
Why do I have to be molested by these sea urchins?
No, buddy, baby. Look, right here, buddy. Here's what it says. Street urchin.
Why would I say sea urchin?
Okay, everybody, what did he say? Huh? Sea urchin, street urchin. Street. Oh, he did say street urchin. I'm sorry, buddy. You're right. Okay, everybody, that's dinner. 1 hour. That includes walking time. 1 hour.
And refers to the kids as sea urchins, which is maybe my favorite line of the movie.
Yeah, well, also, it's Buddy Hackett.
Yeah, exactly. Who doesn't like Buddy Hackett?
Yeah.
Of course, nowadays, you can't be racist or be an alcoholic as funny or be seen as retarded as funny either. So all of his shtick would be worthless in today's modern economy.
Yeah, I just loved him in Herbie the Love Bug.
Oh, he was great in a bunch of stuff. And yeah. he could tell a good dirty joke too.
Yeah, no, I mean on the Carson show.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, he was in The Love Bug. I remember that as being a very sweet movie.
Yeah.
We should do The Love Bug at some point.
We should. That would be awesome.
Yeah. So, next, Frank is visited by the Ghost of Christmas Present, who is one of our favorites, Carol Kane.
Yeah, I wrote Carol Kane, so awesome.
Oh, she is.
Can you guess what my most favorite part of the whole Carol Kane experience of this movie was?
I'll have to have you tell me.
When she smashed him in the face with the toaster.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well,
it was so deeply satisfying.
She's dressed as a fairy, F-A-E-R-I-E, fairy, and she's doing her rendition of what's written out on like a card, like a presentation card on stage as the Ballbuster Suite, as he's playing like the Nutcracker Suite, you know, ba-dum-bum, psh. So the first thing she does is kick him right in the nuts, and then she proceeds to basically beat the crap out of him for their entire time together.
And it's so satisfying.
Oh, yeah. So the first place they visit is Grace's family, where they see that Calvin is a smart kid because he solves the puzzle.
Yeah, and they also show the Black & Decker popcorn maker that is installed on their cabinet, which is just like our parents had.
Oh, yes, an under-the-cabinet popcorn maker.
Hot air popcorn maker.
Yes, but with a section where you can melt your own butter. Because you wouldn't want to use oil to pop your popcorn, but you can use real butter to put on it.
I know. Oh, yeah.
And then we learn that Calvin hasn't spoken since he witnessed his father being killed 5 years ago. They're so happy, but so very poor. And Carol Kane gets him to reluctantly agree to give her a raise, even though he's kicking and screaming during the whole idea of it. By the way, he was reciting his Christmas gift list to his secretary, and he's basically giving everybody either expensive VCRs, sign of the times, or towels. And he even gives his brother a towel. So it shows how cheap he is anyway. So the next place we visit is his brother James's house, where Wendy Malick plays his brother's wife, Wendy, a very young Wendy Malick, and they are playing Trivial Pursuit. The very few things more 80s than Trivial Pursuit. In a good way. I mean, I always enjoy playing Trivial Pursuit.
Yep, I still do. I have it for my Xbox.
Yeah. Anyway, so we have a little conversation with them. And, of course, when James opened his presents, it was a VCR because Grace had given him the VCR instead of the towels. But then we meet Herman, who is frozen to death in the sewer. Herman is one of the guys from the shelter. Frank didn't give him $2 to heat his place, and now he's frozen to death.
And in what seemed to be a very, very, like, incredibly dark, just kind of, I don't know, it seemed disproportionately dark for the movie, but maybe it was just me.
At first, I thought he was going to be the ghost of Christmas Future, because he was frozen solid, but holding the pocket watch.
Yeah.
But nope, nope. So this time when Frank comes out of his ghost visit, he is on the set also. He has to break out, actually, from the sewer area where Herman's frozen, and he breaks right onto the set of Scrooge that's going to start in 3 minutes live. And, of course, again, the network sensor gets injured. And then he freaks out when he sees the actor playing Ghost of Christmas Future. I thought that was actually kind of funny, because he thinks it's the Ghost of Christmas Future, but because they're showing Scrooge, there's a guy who's dressed up like... Anyway. So he goes up to his office, and actually I think he is ushered to his office because he's already caused a problem on the set. So now we see that he is hardly mixing any tab in his vodka at all. And then we get another kind of dark thing. Elliot shows up with a shotgun to kill Frank. Like, you know, workplace violence and everything. Amazing.
It seems like the security that was ever present before has kind of really slackened the job up a bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he is Bobcat, as Elliot, is full-on Bobcat Goldthwait's crazy man. And then they have a very reminiscent scene to the Jane Fonda dream sequence in 9 to 5.
I made the same exact note.
Yeah, it's basically the same sequence.
Yeah.
He goes into the elevator where he meets the ghost of Christmas Future. And this was, again, this, the makeup effects are pretty good. When the Ghost of Christmas Future, you know, open up his robe, you see the bones of his chest cavity with all these little, like, I guess, souls, faces in there. That was a pretty good effect. A little bit of, like, puppetry sort of thing.
Yeah, that was pretty creepy.
Yeah. Again, when they did effects in this film, they did them very well. So I appreciated that. And the Ghost of Christmas Future takes him to Calvin, who is being visited by his mother in his padded cell, which I thought was, like, I don't know exactly. I mean, so because Calvin never got the treatment he needed, he ended up in a padded cell because he's a danger to others?
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't really able to get that myself, so.
Yeah, it was like, weird. But again, it's a little over the top. And then he sees Claire and her friends, and Claire's a heartless old woman who has heeded his advice and scraped off all of her friends, and now she's heavily made up and bitter, and her life is meaningless. But she has nicer clothes, though, so, you know, there's that. And then he visits Wendy, grieving over a coffin that's about to be put in the most expensive, lavish crematorium ever in the history of anything. It's as if they installed a crematorium right in the lobby, like the marbled lobby of the building that he works in. Dream logic, I'm sure, but still. So then he realizes, of course, oh, it's not James's grave, it's Frank's grave. And I thought the coffin scene was actually pretty good.
I wrote that him burning alive is actually pretty gruesome.
Yeah, it's frightening. It's actually pretty fun.
Yeah.
So, and again, I wrote that the Christmas Future really does have some good practical effects. Anyway, so he escapes from the coffin or flashes from the coffin back up to the elevator, and he opens the elevator door, and he is a changed man now. And he...
I want to say, But so when Elliot backs him into the corner and he ends up in the elevator, those elevator doors close in the fastest fashion of any elevator I have ever witnessed.
Oh, yeah. He would have lost a limb during like normal business hours.
I was thinking it was like a JCPenney elevator.
I was going to say JCPenney elevator.
I beat you to it. Ha ha. Okay. But yeah, no, when he comes back a changed man out of the elevator, and he Zerbit's Bobcat's belly, which I wrote, ick.
Yeah, there's that. And Bobcat does a good job of being a little bit bewildered about why all of a sudden he's being promised his job back. But he's now they've become in the space of one good Zerbirding, he and Bobcat are now going to go and commandeer the booth, the control booth of the production, so that Bill Murray can come on and give a nationwide worldwide speech. And so Bill Murray gives this big impassioned speech, which again, I thought rang a little hollow because there was not enough time to develop him as actually changed. He's just a psychotic, like crazy man, but
or drunk.
Yeah. Or exactly. Yeah, totally. And, so he's there, and Bobcat is, you know, holding the control room hostage, which, you know, a hostage scene is always good in a comedy. And, but, you know, damn it, at the end, after he gives this big, long speech, I'm not going to even put in there, Calvin walks up to him and reminds him that he didn't say, God bless us, everyone. And at that point, I'm like, I'm getting a little sniffly. Despite myself, I'm like, I'm not liking this movie. And yet, you know, they got me with the heartstrings with the music and the little kid saying, God bless us, everyone, in his hasn't talked till you saw his dad killed 5 years ago voice.
Right.
And then, in a strange thing, which I'm sure in the theater was perfect, everybody starts singing, Put a Little Love in Your Heart. And Bill Murray is talking directly to the theater audience, and he says, feed me, Seymour, feed me. Because, you know, again, he was in Little Shop of Horrors.
Feed me, Seymour, feed me. Come on, let's hear it for all you folks out there. Come on. You don't know the words. Come on. Come on, let's hear it from this side of the theater. Come on, just over here.
Right. That was funny. Yeah, but then that god-awful song I wrote... Oh, good. We can cue the horrible Annie Lennox and Al Green soundtrack now.
Yeah, well, but he was like having, see, only the men in the audience sing, and only the women in the audience sing. You could do a little louder. And, you know, I thought that was probably fun in the theater, but at home it was like, oh, dear.
The real women, the real women. You know who you are. Are you, who was making all the noise through the whole movie.
My brother, the King of Christmas.
It was funny in 1988.
Again, this movie had lots of funny parts to it, yet I was kind of, I don't know, I was left a little cold by it.
Yeah, it didn't hold up as well.
So it was nice to see all the familiar faces, but Bill Murray just doesn't really do it for me in this kind of role.
Yeah, it wasn't a cohesive movie ever, I think. I think that this movie was... I think the end product of this movie wasn't anywhere close to the original project of the movie. I think it kind of changed as it was filmed. To me, there's big pieces that are missing. And I don't know if that's the case or not, but I hope it's true. Because the movie just doesn't flow together very well.
Well, and, you know, again, maybe this was just sort of rushed out. You know, this is where, you know, Bill Murray was like riding high on the success of Ghostbusters and, you know, Richard Donner had Superman and all that stuff. So it could have just easily been, you know, hey, and this might be a good script and we'll just get all these famous people and put a little bit of money into it. And, you know, because I'm sure it made its money. And much like those Christmas albums that a lot of musical artists still to this day put out. Like, I was amazed that people still buy Christmas albums. Like, has anybody written a new Christmas song in the last 10 years?
But not, I mean, not a lot, but...
Yeah, but still, I know...
We'll crank one out every couple of years.
No, but I know that everybody does covers of all the Christmas classics, and people will buy them every single year. Like, there are probably people with dozens and dozens of Christmas albums.
Sure. Well, and it's great for the artists because they don't have to write anything and they can put their own spin on it. And there's not a lot of royalties because a lot of the songs are public domain.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, this, I think this is that movie. This is the equivalent of that, is that you put out a Christmas movie and.
Well, yeah. And not only that, because the story itself is a Christmas carol. And so, you know, yes, you have to, you had to write some story that was new and fresh, but it's an old story. It's a retelling of a classic.
Well, and everybody's heard it. So you're putting your spin on it. Again, it's the Michael Bublé does the Christmas hits and the same shelf as Justin Bieber does the same Christmas hits. And, you know, Trent Reznor does the same Christmas hits. Well, maybe not quite, but still.
So this movie was budgeted $32 million.
Yeah, it looks it. It looks, you know, it looks good. And how much did it make?
$60 million.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just box office. I mean, again, it's a Christmas movie. They sell DVDs of it still now.
Well, and so they're saying the gross was 60,000 in the U.S., but now, I'm sorry, 60,000, 60 million in the U.S., but also it's 31 million in rentals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and again, this is a big VHS time. I heard another podcast today where I can't remember whose podcast it was. Maybe Mo Mandel on Burt Kreischer's podcast was talking about how there was a porn actor who he was making great money. But of course, he thought he was always going to be making that kind of money. And so when he signed like the latest contract or whatever, this was the late 80s, he's like, oh yeah, you know, there may be these new things like DVDs and laser discs, but who's going to put porn on that? There'll always be videotapes. So he signed away all his rights to DVD profit.
Oh, jeez.
So he retained all the VHS rights to any kind of thing on there where they were selling, you know, copies to, I don't know, video rental stores where you can sell one video for $80 because it's going to be, you know, viewed by a whole bunch of people, so the video stores will pay that much money.
Do people still buy porn?
Oh, I'm sure they do.
It's on the internet. Why would you pay for it? It's free. It's everywhere.
Well, yeah. Well, I don't know. It's like music. Internet destroyed porn like the internet destroyed the music industry.
I mean, for God's sakes, I try and get the websites I want to get to, and sometimes I accidentally get porn sites.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, again. I don't know the answer to that. But I must investigate and I'll get back to you.
Build research.
Yeah, because I'm doing research, honey.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm sure there are places where, well, that's, yeah, weird. We live in a different society now, too.
No, definitely. So we finished the movie.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah. You know, like I said, it has a feel-good ending because of the put a little love in your heart. And all in all, it's a Christmas movie. But I think of the Christmas movies we're going to be talking about, this will be my least favorite.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, it was good to rewatch it. But, I mean, I'll probably go, you know, I'll go at least another 10, 15, 20 years before I watch it again.
Yeah. I will probably watch it at somebody else's suggestion. That'll be how I'll see it again.
Like, didn't I see that already?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this was back when we were in the double-digit episodes, way before we were in the four digits. I don't think we can do Dirty Rotten Scoundrels next week because I don't think I can get a copy of it.
Oh.
I've been trying. I don't think it's available, is it?
Streaming on Netflix.
Oh, it is. Okay, cool. All right. Well, I'll watch it that way then.
Well, at least it was last week because that's how I was going to watch it. Let me look. It was as of last week, but, you know, they updated everything, so God knows.
Oh, exactly.
And, you know, I got a little bait and switch with Netflix. So I'm a little angry, and I realized it was my own brain that did it because I'm like, oh, Good Eats, the Good Eats collection, right? I can watch the Good Eats collection, and so, like, episode one, season one, I'm like, oh, this would be awesome. Like, Alton Brown in the beginning, right?
Oh, yeah.
Except the Good Eats collection.
Oh, it's just random ones thrown together? Random, but like themes?
No, they're random. I think they're like the best ofs, but the order of them is seemingly random. And the first episode, and by the way, I've already watched like six episodes like last night. I stayed up way too late watching them because I get sucked in them because they're so good.
Oh, yeah.
It's good TV. But the first one I watched was, you know, he references another episode, and I'm thinking, how can you be referencing another episode? This is the first episode. And then I was like, I've been duped. I was led down that path. I would have bought this as like a box set and been angry. And I'm, you know, I guess on the one hand, I should be grateful that Netflix saved me from making a purchase that would have made me upset. But then I was like, oh, you tricked me.
Yeah, well, you know, I saw the same thing. You can, for like something like, and I'm sure it's a Christmas season sort of thing, but I think you can buy, it's called the Twilight Zone Collector's Edition. It's the full episode edition. And it shows every single episode of Twilight Zone, but it's not the complete edition. If you want to buy the complete edition, because you can buy it for like $60, I think, which is, you know, like probably over, well over 100 programs. Well, if you want to get every single episode, even like the George Takei one that was never showed because it was like pretty much banned, you have to buy like the Ultimate Collection, which is, oh, I don't know, $130. I think literally it has maybe 5 or 6 episodes that for whatever reason didn't appear on the ones that was like all the broadcast episodes. Like, who would put out, if you're going to be doing like 100+ episodes, I don't know, maybe it was a rights issue or something.
Yeah.
But then I thought, would I want to own all of those now that you can pretty much see them anywhere on rerun? I mean, you know, on demand is pretty, yeah, except of course bandwidth issues. Ugh.
Yeah. I mean, for you, I feel bad for you, but yeah, but sometimes for me though, I like to have them so that I can watch them offline. So I'm not, you know, so I'm not connected.
Oh no, me too.
I would love to own all of the Good Eats programs, all of them, but I'm avoiding looking for that set because I have a feeling I know it probably exists. It's probably very expensive, and I would spend the money, and I don't need to. So,
well, it's basically cooking school.
Yeah, no, it's but they're so great. Even rewatching them, I'm like, great.
I'm serious. I mean, it's entertaining television, absolutely. It's the best kind of television, but it's also, it has practical application. I mean, you could actually watch it as cooking school. And how much would you spend on cooking school? A lot.
It's Food Network when Food Network was about cooking.
Yeah, exactly.
And not contesting.
Yeah. And not just cooking, but things like knife sharpening and what kind of pans to get and very simple, well, seemingly simple, but it could, you know, change the way you do things.
Yeah. Yes, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is still streaming.
Okay, cool. Well, we can certainly do that.
As long as your bandwidth doesn't kill you.
No, it'll be fine. I mean, because it'll be, I think it's 7 days away. I think I'll be okay.
Or you can go watch it at your parents' house.
Well, because they don't have bandwidth problems. They have speed problems. No, and actually now I don't think they have internet. Seriously, the last couple of days they haven't had any internet at all.
At the house?
Yes. It's like their router doesn't work right, and Dad is a little bit... Well, he's really pissed off at them completely for everything that's gone wrong with the ACS. But he's also pissed off because if the guy's like, oh yeah, it's a router. On Thanksgiving Day, they said, oh no, it's a network issue. Well, Monday they said, no, it's actually a router issue. You need to bring your router in. And I can't conceive of what he's talking about, but apparently he's got things wired such that he dreads the idea of having to like unplug everything and bring it back in and then have to bring a new router in. Maybe he has all the cords wrapped or something.
Their router is buried in that 1985 power supply thing that he was still using.
Okay, well, yeah, so he really dreads putting a new router in there, which again, pisses him off.
That's because I suspect it won't go back together.
Yeah, well, again, I don't, who knows?
I suspect the only thing holding it together is age and dust.
Was that a DAC thing?
Yes, it was.
Do you remember DAC?
I do, the DAC bread makers.
Oh man, there were some DAC audio electronics. I had a DAC, dual deck cassette player that was really great.
Yeah, no, DAC was the thing.
Yeah, I love the DAC catalog.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have fond memories of waiting to get the DAC catalog and reading it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Reading it repeatedly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like it was technology porn.
It was totally technology porn in a way that, see, even Sharper Image doesn't really compare to. Because right. Sharper Image was all like luxury porn. And DAC
Sharper Image was stuff I could never afford. DAC was stuff I could afford, but I knew it was going to break.
Well, yeah, but it was really good quality, like audio components, that kind of stuff. And now they have those expensive, control your lights in your bedroom with your cell phone. It's like, yeah, they had all that home automation back then in the DAC catalog. I wonder
Our first bread maker in the house was a DAC bread maker.
Oh, I'm sure they made a shitload of money on DAC bread makers. Because they were that's the only bread maker for a while.
Yeah, that's where I got my recipe for California dip bread.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, exactly. I love that bread. Yeah, so, Drew A. Kaplan, whatever happened to him?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm trying to, I wonder if it's, we have a machine.
We have the technology, huh? Have more bandwidth than you.
Uh-oh. Here we go. So.
DAC Industries.
Yeah. He was in 85, he was involved in a lawsuit with his former printer. And court records showed that he ordered a run of 3.8 million catalogs. But he was also running a $120 million a year business with 400 full-time workers, selling everything from radar detectors and stereo speakers to security lighting systems, handheld photocopiers, and televisions with 2-inch screens. I remember all this. The quarter-inch thick DAC catalog was mailed all over the U.S. and Canada, and it was all first-person ads. And let's see. So, wow, in 1992, he had to file bankruptcy because a Japanese bank pulled his $18 million line of credit. But it went from Chapter 11 to Chapter 7 in 94. And they liquidated all the inventory. He was, I guess it was a bad banking relationship. It was the beginning of the Asian meltdown. So his bank decided to retrench and they lost their whole credit line and they couldn't find an American bank that liked the high volume, low margin business that he built. But
DAC 2000.
Hold on. Huh. Interesting. Yeah. Because apparently Microsoft sued him for copyright infringement, but he won.
Wow. He won against Microsoft?
He did, yes.
By the way, there's a website, DAC2000.com.
Huh, interesting. Wild.
Yeah, that's kind of sad.
It is kind of sad, but yeah. I remember when they had DAC stuff, even before there was a catalog, they had DAC ads in like Omni Magazine. Remember Omni Magazine?
I do remember Omni Magazine.
Yeah, it was the Bob Guccione science magazine.
Yeah, I really miss Omni. It was great.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, so, anyway, how fun.
So, since we're kind of so far afield now, I was watching Charlie Rose, I think I told you.
Oh, yeah, Norman Lear.
Yeah, and I don't... Just something in listening to him talk, it really just hit me. So hearing him talk and looking at him and seeing him speak, it was like channeling our grandmother.
Wow. Well, he's 92 or something, right?
Yeah. But just something in how he was talking and what he was saying and how crazy liberal he is, and it just really reminded me of her. And it was kind of a nice memory, even though it was somebody else. But
just after you mentioned you saw that, Mark Maron put out his Norman Lear episode. So it's available now on WTF.
I'll have to see if I can find it.
No, I miss a lot of little things. Like, I can't go to, like, my wife isn't super adventurous with different kinds of food. And well, my daughter, forget it. But, you know, I used to go with my grandmother, our grandmother, to like the newest Thai place or, you know, like Indian food or whatever it happened to be. We'd go visit all the new restaurants and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now we don't do that, obviously. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.